go to Alaska to help Dan Sullivan get elected.
President Trump endorses Senator Dan Sullivan and offers to hit the campaign trail for him in Alaska. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, September 2nd. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, researchers say a fungal outbreak affecting spruce trees in the Tongass is just nature running its course.
But in the forest, these fungi are part of the ecosystem and they're just playing their role.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly. President Trump says he'll make a campaign swing through Alaska to help U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan.
I will go to Alaska to help Dan Sullivan get elected. Dan Sullivan, it's like Ken Paxton. Dan Sullivan's a great senator. Dan, you look at the things he's done. He would call me all the time because I definitely know nobody has helped Alaska like Donald Trump.
He spoke during an Oval Office press conference today after a reporter asked if he planned to go to Alaska to help a Republican in a tight race. Trump won Alaska handily in 2024, a fact he reviewed in the press conference.
You know, I won Alaska by a landslide.
13.5 points.
How much?
13.5.
Oh, I thought it was 23 or 24.
Why do you think?
13.5 is a lot. What do you think, Peter?
This,
not bad.
Mr. President, you won it by 13.5 points. Why is this race so close?
I don't know. Well, it's close for one reason, that they have a phony Dan Sullivan.
Trump used much of the 3 minutes he spent on Alaska today disparaging the other Dan Sullivan in the race. That's Dan J. Sullivan of Petersburg. Trump repeated many of the unproven allegations the senator and his supporters have made.
The Democrats put up another man named Dan Sullivan. So we have two Dan Sullivans. And by the way, the other man who had never been in politics, had never voted, he hasn't voted for years, a totally pretty non-political person, I guess, but never had any thought of running. All of a sudden, he's running for the Senate in Alaska. His name is Dan Sullivan. They have the same name.
The Petersburg candidate declined an interview request this afternoon. He said he'd been out mushroom hunting and wanted to see the president's remarks in context. But in a text, he asserted that he's a very faithful voter. The retired teacher got 2.5% of the primary vote. That put him in third place behind Democrat Mary Peltola and Senator Sullivan and got him a spot on the November ballot. The Petersburg man has consistently maintained that running was his own idea and that no one put him up to it. A new poll by Alaska Survey Research suggests the race between Peltola and Senator Sullivan is extremely close, with Peltola just over 1 percentage point ahead, despite finishing more than 8 percentage points ahead of Sullivan in the August 18th primary. The same poll shows Trump's popularity in Alaska has dropped, with 56% now holding a negative view of the president. It's not clear what impact a Trump visit would have on the race. In 2022, he held a rally in Anchorage to promote Republicans Kelly Chewbacca for U.S. Senate and Sarah Palin for U.S. House, and both lost. Alaska's public schools are set to receive an additional $115 million in state funding this year from a boost in oil revenues driven by the U.S. war on Iran. The Alaska Beacon reports the State Department of Revenue announced the additional funds on Monday. State lawmakers had earmarked additional oil revenue for K-12 schools as part of the state budget approved by Governor Mike Dunleavy in June. The announcement comes as many districts have faced severe budget shortfalls in recent years due to funding not keeping pace with rising costs. This year, a dozen elementary and middle schools closed across the state. That's a record. According to the announcement, the revenue estimates are expected to be revised and finalized this fall and will likely change slightly, impacting the exact amount that will land in the Budget Reserve Fund, that's the state's savings account. The money will then be distributed to school districts according to the state's education funding formula, which is based on student enrollment counts in October. School officials in Fairbanks and Anchorage told the Beacon they welcomed the extra funding, although they had requested funding estimates earlier in the year as they worked through the budgeting process. Among the state's largest districts, the Anchorage School District is expected to get $32 million, the Matanuska-Susitna Borough School District is expecting over $16 million, and the Kenai Peninsula School District is expecting more than $7.5 million. Well, a former Bethel judge has apparently resigned as head of the state's public defender agency. That's after allegations that he had not acted impartially due to personal grievances in a case he presided over in 2022. But as KYUK's Evan Erickson reports, the governor's office has not actually confirmed the resignation.
Former Bethel judge Terrence Haas became the state's top public defender in September 2023. Last week, he announced in a resignation letter sent to Governor Mike Dunleavy that he was stepping down. That letter was shared with KYUK in an email by the Anchorage Daily News. In the letter, Haas wrote that the governor's office had made his job untenable. Haas writes in the letter that's because of the response of the governor's office to a recent legal pleading which, among other allegations, claims that Haas was romantically involved with his now wife when he was a Bethel Superior Court judge and she was his law clerk. As of Wednesday, the governor's office still hadn't confirmed Haas's resignation or provided comment on the allegations against him. The allegations stem from a new filing in a case first assigned to Haas in 2021. In August of 2022, a Bethel jury convicted Kasiglik resident Peter Albright of 5 counts of first-degree sexual abuse of a minor. 4 years later, the 65-year-old Albright is still awaiting sentencing, and his case remains open amid questions about his competency. This June, Albright's defense attorney filed a motion for a new trial. The motion claims Albright was never evaluated for competency prior to standing trial. Since his conviction, the motion claims the court has found Albright not competent at least 5 times. The motion also claims the court denied Albright a fair and impartial trial due to what it alleges were overlapping romantic relationships between Judge Haas, his former law clerk, and the public defender assigned to the case at the time, Daniel Mizanov. KYUK has withheld the name of the former law clerk based on the fact that she did not have direct responsibility for legal decisions made in the Albright case. Mizanov said in a sworn deposition cited in the motion that he began a romantic relationship with the clerk in early 2022 while Albright's case was still pending. That relationship ended before the trial. When Haas learned of the relationship, Mizanov alleged that his interactions with Haas deteriorated. He said the judge made unreasonable demands and criticized his defense strategy in front of the prosecutor. In the months leading up to the trial, Mizanov said he believed Haas, who was married to a different woman at the time, was also romantically involved with the clerk. Mizanov produced text messages sent to him by the clerk in which she mentioned late-night drinking sessions with Haas in Bethel. The texts include details that Mizanov interpreted as indicating that there was, quote, more going on. Haas has wholly denied the allegations. In an email to the state prosecutor for the case shared with KYUK, he wrote that both he and the former clerk, who he married in 2025, testified unequivocally under oath that no romantic or intimate relationship occurred during her clerkship. The former clerk is currently an attorney with the State Office of Public Advocacy. In Bethel, I'm Evan Erickson.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new nonprofit aims to connect kids from rural Alaska to careers in aviation.
It is very important for us to put rural kids in these positions because they do understand the terrain and the weather.
That's ahead. Stay with us. A black gold transport ore hauling truck wrecked Friday night after it hit a bison on the Alaska Highway about 20 miles southeast of Delta Junction. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Alaska State Troopers say they got a report at around 10:30 p.m. Friday that occurred near milepost 1404 of the Alaska Highway. According to a trooper dispatch, the driver lost control after hitting a bison, and the truck went into the ditch and wound up on its side. The dispatch said emergency personnel had to remove the driver, who was trapped inside the truck. He was then transported to a hospital in Fairbanks for evaluation and treatment. A spokesperson for Kinross, Alaska, said the driver was later released from Fairbanks Memorial Hospital and is okay. Kinross is a mining company that contracts with North Pole-based Black Gold Transport to truck ore from the Mancho Mine near Tetlin to the mill at the Fort Knox Mine north of Fairbanks. The spokesperson said the northbound truck was fully loaded with gold ore from the Mancho. The ore was later recovered and transported to the mill. According to troopers, the Alaska Highway was closed briefly in both directions while emergency personnel removed wreckage from the roadway, and both lanes were later reopened. In Delta Junction, I'm Tim Ellis.
The Juneau Assembly voted Monday night to delay a decision on whether to codify Juneau's voluntary 5-large cruise ship limit into local law. Since 2023, the city and borough of Juneau and cruise lines have negotiated a limit of 5 large ships per day during the cruise season. But that agreement is voluntary and non-binding. Advocates unsuccessfully tried to put it on the ballot in a recent election. At a committee meeting Monday night, the Juneau Assembly discussed a proposed ordinance that would codify Juneau's limit into local law. If approved, it would make it illegal for a sixth cruise ship to berth in the city and borough of Juneau, which includes Douglas Island. Assembly member Ella Atkinson said the Juneau community has made it clear it supports a five-ship limit.
For the many years that I've been on the Assembly, I have seen overwhelming support for the five-ship limit. It's consistently a thing that scores very highly in all of our surveys. It's something that everyone has kind of rallied around as a good thing and a good first step. And the only reason we haven't made it code is because we were not legally able to.
The Assembly has not pursued codifying the limit because it was unclear whether it was legal. Other communities like Bar Harbor, Maine, have tried regulating the industry and wound up in court. Even though Bar Harbor won, Juneau's city attorney Emily Wright told the Assembly that pursuing legal limits would not come without challenges.
There is no scenario where you don't get sued in this. So I want to make that very clear. Someone is going to sue you at any level of this.
The vote to postpone was approved in a narrow 5-4 vote. The city's Visitor Industry Task Force is slated to finish its discussion and make recommendations to the Assembly later this fall. A Seattle startup is betting nuclear power could change how ships move through the Arctic. The company is developing a micro-reactor for maritime use with the goal of keeping ships at sea for longer without refueling. And as KNOM's Ben Townsend reports, the company is partnering with NOAM for another interesting application.
The 8,000-mile voyage from Busan, South Korea, to the European cargo hub of Amsterdam takes about a month and can burn hundreds of thousands of gallons of fuel. Ships can usually make the trip without stopping, but they have to refuel before turning around for the voyage home. That need for fuel is one of the limits on how far and for how long cargo ships can operate, especially on remote routes like the Northwest Passage. A Seattle-based company believes nuclear power could change that. Instead of refueling after every long voyage, a nuclear-powered ship could potentially operate for years without refueling. The company, Emerald Nuclear, is betting that kind of endurance could make Arctic shipping routes more practical, while cutting the emissions and fuel demands that come with conventional ships.
That environment has some very specific constraints that we need to design and develop to.
This is Wesley Deason, CEO of Emerald Nuclear.
Most of my career, I've spent developing nuclear reactors for space applications. So reactors small enough and compact enough that you could put on a rocket to go to the moon or go to Mars.
Deason's specialty is microreactors. Don't think Simpsons-style power plants with giant cooling towers. Microreactors are just that, micro. Think more like the size of a shipping container. All nuclear reactors follow the same basic principle, though. They produce energy through fission. That's a chain reaction of splitting atoms. The process creates huge amounts of heat, which is used to boil water into steam or to heat a gas, which turns turbines that convert that energy into electricity. With a warming Arctic, the prospect of putting a floating heater in the water is worrisome, but Deason says that shouldn't be a huge concern.
We're not putting any more or any less heat into the environment than a standard diesel engine would.
Deason says the company's 5-megawatt GEM microreactor is still in a preconceptual design phase, but that the technology itself is fairly fleshed out.
We thankfully stand on the shoulders of giants with the developers of TRISO Nuclear Fuel, which is this very safe, high-temperature form of nuclear fuel. And then we have to go through a rather expensive development process to test our system in a non-nuclear means in order to prove its safety.
The company envisions building modular microreactors that can be swapped in and out when it's time for refueling and maintenance. Emerald plans to lease the microreactors, shifting some of the regulatory burden of owning a nuclear power plant away from the operator. That leasing model could also apply to floating nuclear power plants serving remote coastal communities. The company reached out to NOAM Joint Utility System this spring to learn more about its rate structure and power usage. Deason says a feasibility study using the NOAM data will be released this fall. One potential advantage, Deason says, is that spent nuclear fuel would never need to remain in the community. Instead, the entire floating plant would return to the company's facility for refueling and maintenance before returning to operation. Arctic communities face some of the nation's highest energy costs because of their dependence on imported fuel. And with prices swinging up and down, it can be hard for utility companies to set a budget. Deason believes this is where the lease model could bring big benefits to rural communities.
And by leasing the reactor at an annual fee, we're able to essentially fit within their current budgeting for how they budget for fuel every year. In fact, we can provide a more consistent price for energy every year because we simply lease it to them.
At 5 megawatts of production, the GEM microreactor could provide enough power to keep the lights on in Nome. Last year, the utility averaged just under 4 megawatts of system load, with more power being drawn in the winter and less in the summer. Ken Morden with the local utility said a microreactor paired with Nome's 2 wind turbines and new battery energy storage system could provide a clean and stable solution for Nome's power needs. But he says how viable it really is depends a lot on the cost. Emerald Nuclear plans to develop a research and training reactor with the Norwegian University of Science and Technology, where future marine reactor operators could train. It's also announced a partnership with Norwegian shipping company Island Offshore as its first commercial customer. For now, the company's Arctic ambitions remain several years away from deployment. Any commercial reactor would still need to complete extensive design, testing, and regulatory review before it could operate aboard ships or provide power to remote communities like Nome. Reporting in Nome, I'm Ben Townsend.
A fungal outbreak is spreading among spruce trees in the Tongass National Forest this summer. As Coast Alaska's Angela Denning reports, the needles might be discolored, but the trees should be fine.
If you've been walking trails near the muskeg, the boggy wetlands in southeast, you might have noticed some spruce trees not looking so great. Earlier this summer, the green needles turned a bright yellow-orange. Now they're more rusty-colored. So what's the deal?
Spruce needle rust.
That's 3-year-old Eli Mulvey talking to his mom.
How do you know it's spruce needle rust?
Because I can see some orange.
On the needles?
Yeah.
Is it busting out?
Yeah.
What kind of organism makes that on the needles?
Fungus. Funguses.
Yep, you're right.
His mom would know. Robin Mulvey is a forest pathologist with the U.S. Forest Service. She recorded that conversation years ago when her son was young. But Mulvey still thinks this fungus is really cool. She says this summer's outbreak is the largest she's seen in her 15 years working in Juneau. It's even on her running shoes.
And I've washed my shoes a few times, and the bottoms of my running shoes are still bright orange. I had spores all over the windshield of my car, on my patio, and I think of it more like a big pollinator. That's kind of the level of damage, and it's just a phenomenon that we can track and enjoy.
The fungus is mostly cosmetic and doesn't hurt the trees. The infected needles will die and drop off, and next year, they'll put out new green growth. It's a natural cycle, but the cycle requires one other part, nearby Labrador tea, also known as tundra tea. Spruce is just the temporary host.
All of the spores that are being produced on Sitka spruce right now, they can't infect spruce. They have to only infect Labrador tea.
How does that even evolve?
I mean, that's a great question. And there are a lot of diseases that have this type of life cycle. This is just one. So we have another one that goes between western hemlock and blueberry leaves. We have another one on one-year-old needles of Sitka spruce that doesn't have an alternate host. It just goes from spruce to spruce.
So given the exact right environment and perfect weather, these fungal spores are produced on Labrador tea leaves in early summer. They float through the air onto new spruce shoots, which become yellow, then orange as the summer goes on. Mulvey says that's the fruiting stage of the fungus. Then the spores blow back to Labrador tea, where they overwinter on the top of the leaves, turning them purple to orange.
And, you know, most people, when they think about disease, they have a negative connotation with that. When there's disease in humans, that's a bad thing. But in the forest, these fungi are part of the ecosystem, and they're just playing their role, is just doing its thing. And so we can kind of appreciate that process.
Although the Labrador tea is infected by the fungus, it's not harmful to humans. But it's still a good idea to harvest plants without spots or discoloration. Reporting for Coast Alaska, in Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning.
Amira Bader is Sea Alaska Heritage Institute's artist in residence at Sitka National Historical Park. Her work combines drawing, watercolor, and formline design, a traditional art style used by indigenous peoples of the Pacific Northwest that incorporates curved lines and shapes. Sitka's flora will be her main subject.
The work is kind of like rooted in like grieving and memory and the cycle of life. If you can truly be present with the flower and like really look at it, you're like really getting to see something beautiful. But in the end, that like flower is totally going to die. But then after that, another flower is going to come back.
Bader is currently based in Albuquerque, New Mexico. She says she had been wanting to come to Southeast Alaska for a long time because of her family's roots.
It's a gift to be able to come here and meet people and learn more about the culture and see where I fit in here. And I've learned a little bit about my family lineage already.
She says her time in Sitka has been peaceful and that this would not be her last trip there. You can visit Bader at Sitka National Historical Park through Friday. A new nonprofit called PENIAC launched last week to connect youth in rural Alaska with careers in aviation. The kickoff event held at Merrill Field in Anchorage brought together about 100 people, including aviation leaders and Senator Lisa Murkowski. Aljona Nyden with the Alaska Desk has the story.
Anchorage's Merrill Field was buzzing as about 100 people gathered to celebrate the launch of a new aviation nonprofit. The crowd included several young students, like Jordan Lewis. Lewis works as a ramper for Grant Aviation and is from the village of Chifornik in southwestern Alaska. He is only 22 years old, but he's already earned a private pilot license and over 250 hours of flight time. And he dreams even bigger.
I want to fly for the big airlines one day, but my small goal is to fly for like the rural villages first.
Lewis says he became interested in aviation because his grandfather was a village airline agent and he'd follow him to meet the planes. He says the field is crucial in Alaska.
There's like hundreds and hundreds of villages that aren't on the road system. And I believe if it wasn't for aviation, most of those villages wouldn't continue to exist.
Lewis was one of the students who took aviation classes through a career training organization called Alaska Excel. The classes have been offered for about 8 years through different local organizations. But program leaders say the new nonprofit called PENIAC will help them get funding more reliably and make classes more sustainable. Students can enroll in piloting, aviation maintenance, and ground handling courses, as well as get mentorship and career opportunities through PENIAC. The program might offer a dispatcher course soon, too. Jamie Clays is the founder and chair of PENIAC.
It is very important for us to put rural kids in these positions because they do understand the terrain and the weather, and they have an invested interest in the community and the people they're flying.
Clays is originally from Bettles in interior Alaska and says she understood early on that rural Alaskans depend on aviation, but it's hard for them to get jobs in the industry. That's why Clays decided to teach her first aviation course through Alaska Excel 8 years ago. Since then, instructors have worked with Alaska organizations and school districts to help connect students to aviation classes and, in some cases, to travel to Anchorage to attend them. Clays says up to 200 students enrolled at the height of the program. But 2 years ago, Clays says some partnering organizations lost federal funding and had to cut their support for the program. Enrollment went down too.
I didn't ever want to see this program stop, and so I needed to do something that was going to help it grow.
Clays named the new nonprofit PENIAC in honor of Ellen PENIAC, the first Alaska Native woman to become a licensed pilot. PENIAC died in 2008, but her family flew from across the state and country to celebrate the nonprofit's launch. Lotie Jones is PENIAC's aunt from Utqaghaviq.
I'm glad that she's recognized, you know, because it took a lot for her to pursue her dream.
Senator Lisa Murkowski also attended the event and said that PENIAC was not only a pilot, but also an ivory carver, a writer, and a mentor who
was willing to pay that forward to help so many others. and particularly young Native kids from the villages, those who needed to be encouraged.
Murkowski commended the program leaders for their work to meet the needs of Alaska's growing aviation sector. Joel Kamikov is a 17-year-old from Kotlik who dreams to become a pilot too.
I dream working in medevac because I get to help people and that makes me feel good. And also, like, being in the plane and in the air clears my mind.
For a start, Kamikov took a ground handling class through the program last spring to learn how to fuel and load an airplane. In Anchorage, I am Alena Naitin.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin and Alyona Naiden in Anchorage, Evan Erickson in Bethel, Tim Ellis in Delta Junction, Clarice Larson in Juneau, Ben Townsend in Nome, Angela Denning in Petersburg, and Lauren Salemo in Sitka. Our audio engineer is Crystal Hyde, Kirsten Dobroth is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.